Thank you, Mark Larson. It is July 3rd. And as we stand here on the eve of Independence Day, I think it's really important to consider a couple of parts in the conversation that sometimes go overlooked. What are we celebrating on Independence Day? Well, we're celebrating our rights. But our rights weren't created by the founders. They were enshrined, right, in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. But in the Declaration of Independence, they were laid out as a vision. As a vision. And that these were rights granted by God to we, the people. And I want to bring on a good friend of mine, Father Bill Nicholas. He's out of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. He and I have been friends for a very long time. And I want to welcome you here, Father Bill, to talk about the thread about the freedom of religion, not just the freedom of worship, but the freedom of religion and the notion of God and all that comes with that in this amazing document that is 241 years old tomorrow.
Hi, Brad. It's good to be with you again. And it's often overlooked, especially in light of the First Amendment. It's really interesting. You look at these different secular activist groups, and they interpret the First Amendment to be a freedom from religion rather than a freedom of religion. And I often wonder if we applied that to the other freedoms that the First Amendment gives, if we were to say it guaranteed a freedom from speech or a freedom from the press, our president might like that. But they somehow they interpret it as freedom from religion when it's actually freedom of religion, something that the founding fathers, while not all of them, some of them were, but not all of them were religious men, they nonetheless found it as an important part of the society that they wanted to try and develop. Because, you know, in the end, it would only take people of a religious moral foundation to maintain the standards that under which a democracy can survive, because without any kind of moral standards, anything goes. You have anarchy. And in order to have real freedom, you need to have a moral compass in which we do that of our own accord, rather than a government that imposes a moral standard on the rest of us.
When you look at these founders, as we consider the Declaration of Independence, and I asked Dr. Kevin Gutzman a similar question when I was speaking with him about Thomas Jefferson and his role as a founding father and a revolutionary in helping to draft this document, the Declaration of Independence. Do you think these were just regular men at the right time to emerge and lead this country in this direction? And I think I can guess what the answer is. Were these men providentially chosen, sort of in a similar way to the Greatest Generation in World War II, that they were supposed to be the people at that time, at that place, to lead this country toward independence?
Well, I think, again, yeah, we could all guess as to what the answer to that would be. And that is certainly yes. I mean, how did these men come together at just the right time for this to develop? Especially as, you know, philosophy, political philosophy, is developing away from absolute power of monarchs to the sovereignty of the people, who would still choose leaders to govern them, or, for lack of a better word, rule over them. But still, as it says in the Declaration of Independence, that the government derives its power from the consent of the governed. That was relatively new back then. We tend to take it for granted. But at the same time, if I were to ask someone nowadays, who has sovereignty, who is the sovereign or the superior authority or has superior power in our country, you'd be amazed at the answers I would get from people. Some would say the president. Some would say the Supreme Court. And very few of them would actually say, we the people. Mm-hmm. Because I guess human nature still might move toward looking to a supreme person. But the idea of the people collectively, through such things as elections, exercise sovereignty in this country. And, getting back to the initial question there, the founding fathers knew that, you can't just have ruled by the people in a vacuum. It has to have some kind of moral compass attached to it. And I forget which one, but one of the founding fathers, I think it was Alexander Hamilton, he also looked at the other big revolution at the time, came on the heels of ours, was the French Revolution, which was based on secular atheistic principles. And he saw what it descended to in the Great Terror that followed the French Revolution. That's not something that happened in our revolution. We had a war, yes, people were killed, people died, and just as the French Revolution produced Napoleon, the American Revolution produced George Washington, but you see, again, they're two very, very different leaders, and whereas the French Revolution was based upon atheistic secular principles, the Declaration of Independence specifically states no less than four times, twice at the beginning, twice at the end, reference to the laws of nature and nature's God, rights that are endowed by their creator. Then toward the end at the formal Declaration of Independence, after giving all their reasons in their relation with Great Britain and the King of England, they appeal to the supreme judge of the world. And that very last paragraph, they mention a reliance on the protection of divine providence. Our Declaration of Independence is not very long, but within it, four times, they bring up reference to a God who exists, a God to whom we owe, from whom we receive our rights and to whom we owe our ultimate allegiance, who in the end will judge us, and that who they ask for the protection in this cause, something that is very different from the French Revolution. And we did not see our country descend into a chaos or to a great terror or a reign of terror, even when the first constitution, so to speak, was less than successful, the Articles of Confederation. Again, it didn't descend into chaos and anarchy. Our founding fathers came together and developed a new system, a different system, that was more conducive to protecting the liberty of the citizens, the rights of the state, and the security of a free people.
When you look at the wording, especially in that first paragraph, and the wording is very specific, we are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is written in that order on purpose, specifically mm-hmm. for a purpose. What do you read into
that? What do I read into that is, well, first of all, I mean, again, things can be cliche today, right to life, right to choose, right to, I mean, I think nowadays people are saying right to an education, right to health care, right to this, right to that. But all other rights are completely obsolete if one does not have the right to life. And I remember someone once saying to me, you know, there are more issues on the shelf. I just simply said, the right to life is the shelf.
Very good.
Without the shelf, there'd be nothing on the shelf. And you know, there are no other rights without the right to life. Liberty is the right to choose one's own destiny based on one's values, and then third is the pursuit of happiness. We're alive, we're free to pursue our life. And again, it doesn't say we have a right to happiness; we have a right to pursue happiness. And you know, I think the founding fathers, I believe the founding fathers, but we might even say we know the founding fathers,
sure,
chose their words very carefully because this document was subject to debate. I think initially it was the right to life, liberty, and property, but the founding fathers debated that and changed the wording to the rights endowed by their creator to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So they chose the words very, very carefully, which means all four references to God in the Declaration of Independence were also chosen. And there are those who would have people convinced that the Founding Fathers were anti-religious or anti-religion and not men of faith. And that may be true of some, but they still saw the value of faith in a society and worked that into their Declaration of Independence. There's a higher power behind this. And as you're saying, as you said earlier, all these men coming together at the right time, they perhaps recognize that, maybe not among themselves, but certainly hoping and acknowledging there is a higher power that they are calling upon to grant authenticity and protection to their cause.
I contended earlier in the show, I contend this is the big bang of politics. In really, it's a starting point because so many other countries have followed our lead, right? As we are sort of the grandfather of this idea of a constitutional government structured in this way with the Declaration of Independence. And many countries have aspired to what we did. And I contended earlier, and I may be off my rocker, I think there are similarities when you talk about the immense risk that was taken, when you talk about what they were facing in terms of similar empires. I think there is a similarity between the 12 in the upper room, right, the apostles, and what these 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence were doing. They were taking on the biggest empires in the history of mankind. They were risking everything for an idea and a belief and a faith that it would work out. Is that, am I off my rocker to see a similarity in terms of motivations and outcomes?
Well, the Last Supper was a different context and a different event,
right.
And eventually the 12 apostles and those that were added to their company, St. Paul was obviously a 13th,
sure.
And Matthias replaced Judas. But I like to refer to the apostles as the founding fathers of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus ultimately is the founder of the church,
right.
But the apostles, I like to refer to them as the founding fathers of the church, and they had to grapple with how it's to be preached, who it's to be preached to, just Jews, just Gentiles.
Mm-hmm.
How do they come to understand an expectation of that we're the idea that we're saved, and yet it was a risk to worship, in a way that was openly contrary to the cultic practices of the Greco-Roman society, which led to persecutions early on in the church's history. Local persecutions in the first century, but by the time you got to Diocletian in the 3rd century, 4th century, it was empire-wide and quite widespread. And so they knew that there was a risk. It was something that caused fear in them. You know, these were the men who abandoned Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane after he was arrested, who eventually developed the courage they had to give everything, their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor, or as Abraham Lincoln put in the Gettysburg Address, that last full measure of devotion. Which was their lives and giving their lives for this faith. In the Declaration of Independence, these men were pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, and there are a number of them who did not survive the Revolution. Their property didn't survive. Some of them were imprisoned. We hear about the likes of Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, but there were those that did lose everything.
Sure.
Their families were imprisoned, or they came home to a community that was more loyalist than revolutionary, and were ostracized because they voted for independence. So they did risk quite a bit.
It is an amazing event, and 241 years ago tomorrow, the Declaration of Independence, Independence Day, we celebrated. It's so important to have the context. Thank you so much, Father Bill, for coming by. We appreciate you giving us this context, and look forward to talking with you very soon.
Yeah, great to be back, and have a great 4th of July.
You too. Happy Independence Day. That's Father Bill Nicholas from the Archdiocese of L.A. 800-760-KFMB for any final thoughts you have.